Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Joe Hunninger, your moderator for tonight's program. Legal strategies in the fight for marriage equality. Tonight's program is co-sponsored by the LGBT member-led forum, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Bailiff, the Bay Area's LGBT Bar Association. On May 15, 2008, the California Supreme Court held that the Constitution guarantees same-sex couples the same right to marry that has been enjoyed by opposite-sex couples for millennia. On November 4, 2008, 52% of Californians approved Proposition 8, which is intended to amend the California Constitution to strip the right to marry from same-sex couples. On November 5th, suits were filed in the California Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8. The court agreed to consider arguments on, one, whether Proposition 8 is invalid because it constitutes a revision rather than an amendment to the Constitution, and two, whether Proposition 8 violates the separation of powers doctrine under the California Constitution. The briefing on all sides has been completed, and now we're ready for oral arguments. Oral arguments will take place before the court on March 5th. This evening, our panelists, Mr. Shannon Minter and Ms. Therese Stewart, both of whom will be arguing before the Supreme Court, will discuss the arguments to be made to the court, the arguments of Proposition 8's proponents, and perhaps, I hope, some predictions on how the court will rule. Would you please welcome my two heroes, Terry Stewart and Shannon Minter. Shannon Minter is the legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, one of the nation's leading advocacy organizations for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Shannon was NCLR's lead attorney on Sharon Smith's groundbreaking wrongful death suit, you might remember that, and has litigated many other impact cases in California and across the country. In 2005, Shannon was one of 18 people to receive the Ford Foundation's Leadership for a Changing World Award. Shannon has received many other awards that are too numerous to recount here. Shannon was also one of the lead counsel in the marriage case which held that same-sex couples have the fundamental right to marry. And now, Shannon is again fighting for fairness and equality in challenging Proposition 8. Shannon Minter.
Thank you, Joe. Such an honor to be here tonight with my colleague, Terry Stewart. And before I launch into the topic of the evening, our Prop 8 challenge, I just want to note that the City Attorney's Office of San Francisco has played such an incredible leadership role in establishing equal rights, civil rights for the LGBT community, and it should be acknowledged. They were on the lead with the Equal Benefits Ordinance. They actually played a very instrumental role in Sharon Smith's wrongful death case with an amicus brief that articulated the theory that was actually adopted by the court, and of course were are right alongside same-sex couples fighting for the freedom to marry before the California Supreme Court. Our case was the only case of all the marriage equality suits brought across the nation that had an actual entire municipality standing up for equality for our community. So we're enormously appreciative of the role that your office has played. So here we are. With three petitions challenging Proposition 8 pending before the California Supreme Court. I'm counsel in one along with Lambda and the ACLU and some private firms representing Equality California and same-sex couples. There is another suit brought by a private attorney on behalf of same-sex couples, a private attorney from Southern California. And then a third suit where my colleague here, Terry Stewart, from the San Francisco City Attorney's Office represents, again, the City of San Francisco, also the City and County, right, of Los Angeles, and a number of other municipalities and counties. So those are the three petitions. All three petitions advance the same basic legal argument, which is that Proposition 8 was improperly enacted as an amendment. That Proposition 8 represents such a significant change to our constitutional system and structure that it must be deemed a revision We're going to come back to that in a minute, and actually Terry's going to lay out a little in a little more depth for you exactly how that argument works. But I wanted to talk for a minute before we go there, really in order to understand the legal arguments challenging Proposition 8, it's absolutely critical that we keep in mind that the constitutional landscape in which these arguments are being advanced has been definitively established now by the California Supreme Court in the marriage cases. And that is a really critical piece of this picture. So I wanted to review what we know. What do we know going into this challenge? We know that the right to marry is, in fact, a protected fundamental freedom, a fundamental right under the California Constitution. That was actually questioned in the marriage case, but the court has laid that to rest and made clear that, yes, under Article 1, Section 1 of the California Constitution, as part of the Declaration of Rights, and it is actually the provision of our state constitution that identifies certain rights as inalienable, which we'll feature later in the Prop 8 when we get to the Prop 8 challenge. Those include the right to liberty and privacy, among others. That is the textual basis for the fundamental right to marry in California. So that much we know. Yes, fundamental right to marry protected under Article 1, Section 1 of our state constitution. We also know that same-sex couples, lesbians and gay men, have that same fundamental freedom to marry, the fundamental right to marry that is protected for all other Californians under our state constitution. That was obviously one of the core issues in the marriage case, and our court was the first in the country to hold that same-sex couples have a fundamental right to marry. Massachusetts High Court did not go so far. Our court did. We also know that the very same famous, infamous 14 words that are in Proposition 8, that only marriage between a man or a woman, man and a woman, is valid or recognized in California. We know that those words, that language, establishes a facial classification based on sexual orientation. We know that because those are the same words that were used in Proposition 22, which was a statutory initiative that was struck down by the California Supreme Court in the marriage cases. And it was actually a very hotly contested issue in that case whether or not those 14 words establish a facial classification, a classification that facially discriminates on the basis of a person's sexual orientation. The court reached that issue, considered it, and has a fairly lengthy discussion in the marriage cases saying, yes, even though the words gay and lesbian don't appear in the text, even though the word sexual orientation doesn't appear in the text, that the purpose and effect of that language is to exclude gay and lesbian couples, it facially discriminates. So we know, therefore, Proposition 8 establishes a facial classification based on sexual orientation. The last really critical thing that we know in terms of what counts for our Prop 8 challenge is that discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation is subject to the very highest level of constitutional scrutiny under the California Constitution, that it is, in the classic legal parlance, suspect classification. So that is the established, not up for grabs, not up for revisiting constitutional framework that will apply and that the court will have in its mind as it considers our Prop 8 challenge. What that means is that Proposition 8 is, if the court were to permit it to stand as a valid amendment of our state constitution, it would be the first time that the people have, by initiative, amended, successfully amended our state constitution to take away a fundamental right selectively just from one minority group based on a suspect classification. And the gist of our argument, which Terry Stewart's going to lay out in more depth, is that that is such a fundamental change to such an important core underlying principle of the Constitution, equal protection, that it cannot, that cannot possibly be considered a mere amendment. It's too serious. Has to be a revision of the state constitution. The last little piece I'll throw into the mix here before turning it over to Terry is that the Attorney General was the named defendant in the three petitions and had to respond to the challenges to Prop 8. And as probably everyone in the room is now aware, the Attorney General took the unusual but not unprecedented step of publicly taking the position that Proposition 8 is not a valid amendment of the California Constitution. He did not embrace the same theory that was put forward in the three petitions. Advanced an alternative theory based on the fact that the right to marry is grounded in Article 1, Section 1, which again, identifies certain quote-unquote inalienable rights. So the Attorney General has a slightly different perspective on this and is saying that certain rights that are labeled textually in the Constitution as inalienable cannot be taken away through the amendment process. With that, I think I'll turn it over to you, Terry, to kind of lay out a bit more the substance of our argument.
And, Terry, before you begin, let me give you a little introduction, if you don't mind. First of all, thank you, Shannon, very much. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on legal strategies in the fight for marriage equality with our guests, Ms. Terry Stewart and Mr. Shannon Minter. I want to remind you that you can submit written questions to be asked at the end of the presentations. Now, Shannon actually did my introduction of Terry. So we think alike. So let me find what I have and I will tell you what
it bears
what
repeating.
I it bears exactly repeating. It does. Terry Stewart spent the first 20 years of her legal career in private practice at Howard Rice, which is a very respected local law firm. While at Howard Rice, she took the time to help shape civil rights history. Shannon mentioned this, the Equal Benefits Ordinance, which was argued, I guess, in 1997. Terry was a significant part of that effort. And then in 2002, she joined the San Francisco City Attorney's Office as the Chief Deputy City Attorney, overseeing all of the city's litigation. In addition to doing all of this groundbreaking constitutional work that Terry's been involved in, she supervises attorneys who handle bus accidents and police abuse cases and overseeing the defense of suits against laws that the supervisors have adopted. The most important thing I think about what Terry does, though, is the constitutional fights that she has waged on behalf of the city. So first of all, Terry and her team defended the mayor and the county clerk when they issued marriage licenses to same-sex couples in 2004. Then, working with Shannon, she and her team successfully filed suit against the state on behalf of the city and county of San Francisco, and together they won same-sex couples the right to marry. And now, again with Shannon, I mean, we've got the dynamic duo here that really is doing great work for us. So now Terry's working on challenging Proposition 8. Terry Stewart.
Thank you. I just want to say that Shannon and I have sort of been joined at the hip now for going on 5 years, and it's been really wonderful because Shannon has tremendous depth of expertise in matters involving sexual orientation in the law that I don't necessarily have. My background is broader, so being able to work with such an amazing person on these cases has been sort of the only thing that is comparable is just getting to work on them at all. Let me start by just talking a little bit about background, about the Constitution and this whole concept of revision and amendment. And it goes all the way back to 1849 when we first created our Constitution in California. And in a often sort of not very well known act of the constitutional framers, they drew a line. The people who were acting in the Constitutional Convention drew a boundary that was a restriction on themselves. And that boundary was a boundary between different types of changes that could be made to the Constitution. And the boundary described one type of change or called it a revision, and another type an amendment, didn't define either term, but basically said that revisions had to be accomplished by a fairly lengthy and difficult, onerous process. And a revision was something that one of the first cases to look at that distinction held something that changed the Constitution in a really meaningful way, altered fundamental principles, principles that were intended by the framers to endure for a long time. And so in view of the notion of a revision as something that really made a big and material change to principles that were core to the Constitution, the requirement was that it was a three-step process. The legislature would propose a constitutional convention. The voters would decide whether to have one. The voters would then elect delegates to the convention. The convention would occur, and the convention delegates would propose changes to the Constitution, and then that would go back to the voters for ratification. Subsequently, that's been changed so that an alternative route is a little less difficult, but still multi-step process where the legislature, two-thirds of each house, proposes a change, and that goes to the voters, and they then vote on it. And in that process, there's a great deal of discussion, of debate, sometimes compromise, hearings, studies presented, all that sort of thing that you would hope would happen before we would make really big changes. The other type of change, the amendment, was one that required less onerous procedures to change. In the beginning, they actually required a change somewhat like the second one I've just described. But today, more recently, it was changed so that the initiative amendment process could be used to make an amendment, a change that's called an amendment. And again, going back to that first case that ever looked at that distinction in a significant way, a case called Livermore, the court said that amendments are things that are within the lines of the original document, amendments that make sort of improvements. Maybe they go to the application of particular principles, but they basically they don't dramatically depart from these really core enduring principles. So in later cases, there haven't been many cases, as you even though our opponent refers to a lavish body of jurisprudence in this area. In fact, there are all of nine, or some have said 10, but really substantively nine cases that have addressed what situations where something was debated as either to be an amendment or a revision. And a number of things kind of come out of those cases, but I wouldn't say the landscape has been fully filled in. One of them is that there can be something called a quantitative revision and something called a qualitative one. And a quantitative one is a change that makes so many changes to the Constitution that affect so many provisions that it's really kind of a wholesale redo, if you will. And that hasn't the voters haven't tried to do that through the amendment process very often because they did it pretty far back, and the court looked at the scope of this broad set of changes that made changes all over the place. The one that I always laugh about is something having to do with oleomargarine, but also all these commissions on different topics that had nothing to do with each other and changed a lot of different provisions. And the court said, you know, this is a quantitative revision, end of story. It has to go through the more deliberative process. But more recently than that case, most of the cases that have come up for consideration by the court have involved what the court has considered whether it was a qualitative revision. And what the court has said there is that even a relatively simple and very short provision can have such a significant effect on the Constitution that it will be considered a qualitative revision. So it doesn't have to change like hundreds of sections of the Constitution in order to be a revision. There's a qualitative degree of change that is enough to make something have to go through that more deliberative process. And then one other strand that has come out of the court's cases, and it has been a focus of many of them, and I think there's been a tendency to look at it as sort of a critical element for a revision, but I don't necessarily think that it is. That is, most of the court's cases talk in terms of changes that alter the fundamental structure of our government and have looked at changes in that way to see, for example, whether they alter the balance of powers between the different branches or take a tremendous amount of power away from one branch and shift it elsewhere, for example, to the federal courts. And so a lot the courts have looked at in evaluating the various measures that have been challenged, What effect do they have on the way that we govern ourselves? But I think that there is room to argue, and the court has not yet really squarely confronted this issue, and I don't think it's really been argued before, something that's related a little bit to what the Attorney General has done, and that's to talk about, even aside from whether something changes the structure of the Constitution, and I'm going to go back to that because I think Proposition 8 does, can a change that also dramatically affects core principles, principles that are in our Declaration of Rights, just by the effect it has on those principles, those rights, be a revision, even if it affects no structural change? And we argue here that that is another reason, as the Attorney General analyzes that inalienable rights section of our Constitution and the effect of this provision on that section, that that is another, a further reason that it is a revision that stands alone. So let me go back and tell you then what our theories are of why Proposition 8 is a revision quickly, and then I think there will probably be questions that will allow us to flesh that out. The structural aspects, the structural changes that Proposition 8 makes have to do with what happens if the court holds that a measure like this can be adopted by simple amendment. And under the Constitution as we have understood it up to this point, there is a balance of power between the majority and the minority. And that balance of power is affected by the equality provisions of our Constitution, the equal protection provisions, and to some degree by all of the rights provisions, because they all speak in terms of all people shall have this right, no people shall be denied this right. And that equality principle kind of weaves its way in every thread of our Declaration of Rights. And the enforcement of that equality principle has always been entrusted to the judicial branch. Why? Because the judicial branch isn't beholden to the politics of the majority quite to the same degree as the other two branches. Now, why does that matter? Well, the whole concept of equal protection and of protecting, treating people equally is a recognition that we as people have some tendency towards a failing that has been common over time. And that is to not always be able to see the full humanity of other people and to be able to adopt laws that are harsh when we can adopt laws that apply only to someone else and don't apply to ourselves. And in recognition of our sort of common failing, if you will, over the course of history, framers of constitutions have put these equal protection provisions in, and they have expected and designated effectively the courts as the enforcers of those provisions. Because without the courts there, if it's left to those branches of government solely that are very responsive to the majority, then it's not so likely to be well enforced. But there is also a role for the legislature in enforcing equal protection, and frankly, for all three branches. And so what Proposition 8 does insofar as if it is permitted to be enacted by simple majority vote is it takes the responsibility for ensuring that minorities are treated equally under our Constitution, takes the role away from the legislature to the extent the legislature acts as a filter through hearings and other processes where there are discussions on both sides. But most of all, it denies the court that responsibility which the court itself has characterized as one of its most important, probably its actual most important function, and that is to enforce those rights. And it also, it guts thereby equal protection. It kind of cuts to equal protection at its core, because this isn't an inequality that is one that's minor in the rights that are at stake. It isn't an inequality that is between two groups that really, a majority and a minority, where the minority is a group that isn't a vulnerable group that can't protect itself through the democratic process. This is the kind of violation of equal protection that goes to a minority that has been held to be part of a class where if the laws distinguish against that class or make differences are suspect and that have to be given the highest level of constitutional scrutiny. It's where there's the most risk that a majority will treat that minority unfairly. And so effectively, if Proposition 8 is upheld, we really are taking the equal protection principle out of our Constitution and saying, you know, it's up to majorities by simple majority vote to decide whether to treat people equally. And as we know, the reason equal protection is in the Constitution is so as not to simply allow majorities of people to make that decision. So the structural changes, again, are taking that responsibility away from the legislature, taking it away from the courts. And in that regard, we also argue, because the court asked us to address it, that because that's such a core function of the judiciary, to have the last word on treatment of minorities and majorities and on equalities issues, that is a violation of separation of powers, that to allow a law like that allows a majority to take away rights would violate separation of powers, and that any law that would violate separation of powers is something that has to go through the revision process if we're going to amend the Constitution to allow that kind of change. So that's the nutshell version of the structural argument. The one other argument, as I mentioned, is as the Attorney General has argued, there are certain rights that are labeled in our Constitution as inalienable, and those include liberty and privacy. And as Shannon mentioned earlier, the court held that the fundamental right to marry is protected by both the Liberty Clause and the Privacy Clause of our Constitution. And so the Attorney General says, well, inalienable has to mean something, and it can't just mean that it can be changed simply by a majority vote. The Attorney General has not agreed with us that it is a revision, that Proposition 8 is a revision, but we think that his argument basically shows that it's a revision, because if you're going to make a change, putting aside for a moment equal protection and the equality principle, but if you're going to make a change that deprives a group of these so-called inalienable rights by simple majority vote, they're not very inalienable in that event. And therefore, when the framers created that boundary line, it's the kind of change that they would have expected to undergo that more deliberative, that more careful process. And now, at the risk of having hopelessly confused you, I think I'll bounce it back to Joe.
Thank you. You're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on legal strategies in the fight for marriage equality with our guests, Ms. Terry Stewart and Mr. Shannon Minter. I remind you that you can submit written questions to be asked at the end of the presentations, which is now. So I'm going to start with the questions, and we'll see where we go. The first question I had, actually, which may have been answered, but I'm going to give this to Shannon. So what do you think about the argument of the California Attorney General?
Well, as we indicated in our briefs, we agree with the Attorney General's argument. I think the argument was initially misunderstood and somewhat misrepresented in the press as relying on some sort of natural law theory, some claim that the court should look outside of the boundaries of the California Constitution and rely on some antiquated notion of natural law and conclude that Proposition 8 somehow violates that. Not at all. It is a textually based theory, and the Attorney General is absolutely correct that the court has established in prior cases that when it's construing our state constitution and there is a potential tension or conflict between existing provisions of the Constitution, the court is supposed to harmonize those provisions where possible. And here we have, on the one hand, Article 1, Section 1, identifying certain rights as inalienable. That is the word used in the text of our Constitution. On the other hand, we have provisions giving the people the power to amend the Constitution. If a right can be amended or easily amended, as Terry just pointed out, it's not very inalienable. So the court has got to somehow reconcile these two provisions of our state constitution, and the Attorney General has suggested that the most reasonable way to do that is to hold that the people could amend these inalienable rights, but only if they can show or if there is a compelling state interest for doing so. So I do think that theory has an enormous amount of merit. However, I think that the theory that we put forward, the argument that we in the city of San Francisco have put forward to the court, is a more direct and narrow and straightforward route to the same result. I mean, if you look at the case law, limited as it is, on the distinction between amendment and revision. The court has set forth some basic principles. And this case, if Proposition 8 is not a revision of the California Constitution, it's hard to know what in the heck would be a revision, because equal protection is so central, and this is such a shocking evisceration of that principle.
Do you have anything to say on that, Terry?
I think Shannon said it really well. I don't have anything to add.
Perfect. Okay, the concept of sexual orientation seems only a couple of decades old. What is the origin of this concept, and what and who guarantees its legitimacy such that it has become pivotal, as in striking down Proposition 22?
This is equal protection, the question goes to? Say the first sentence again.
The concept of sexual orientation seems only a couple of decades old.
Read the question one more time.
Okay.
That's
fine. Yeah, it's a little difficult. The concept of sexual orientation seems only a couple of decades old. What is the origin of this concept, and what or who guarantees its legitimacy such that it has become pivotal, as in striking down Proposition 22? So it does bring in equal protection and other things.
So the question is you know, sort of what is the origin of the concept of sexual orientation? And I think if you look way back, people who've studied anthropology and history know that there have been people of a sexual orientation different from the majority, namely people of a same-sex sexual orientation, in every time period that's been studied and across every culture that's been studied. My understanding of the history may not be completely precise, but it is that somewhere along the 6th century, or give or take, some religious doctrines developed condemning homosexuality. And at first it was sort of a small condemnation, but it grew with Christianity and kind of took root and took hold. It didn't speak in terms of sexual orientation. It spoke in terms of sexual practice, specifically sodomy, or men lying with men, or things of that nature. Over the centuries after that, because of the condemnation in the Western world that came with this religious set of doctrines, people who had a homosexual orientation or a same-sex sexual orientation basically did not dare sort of show who they were. It was, you were at risk in many periods of that history in the Western civilizations of being murdered or killed by the state if people knew that you were that you ever had same-sex sexual intimacy. And so the concept of part of the reason I think that it wasn't addressed as a matter of sort of people's identity, if you will, or orientation, is because the Christian faiths were somewhat, some of us might say, obsessed, but at least focused on sexuality and focused on what was the right kind of sex to have and the wrong kind of sex. And it was very much a part of church doctrine. And so they focused on the sexual conduct, if you will, rather than on orientation. You have to fast forward quite a bit, I actually think the concept of same-sex sexual orientation does date way back to earlier civilizations, including those in Asia, including ancient Greece, including many other places that weren't at the time Christian nations. But in our sort of more contemporary society, I think it was a couple of centuries ago that people began to realize that there were, as urban areas developed in our country, people began to find other people who were like them and realize that there were more people of a similar sexual orientation, and that it was not just some so strange aberration, and began to realize that they might begin to stand up for themselves and begin to view themselves as something that wasn't so horrible as had been portrayed. And over time, more and more, I think, gay people have stood up and said, we don't want to be treated differently. We don't want to be hated. We don't want to be despised. And we do want to be who we are and not try to fit into a mold that doesn't fit for us. I think how that relates to striking down laws like Proposition 22, is that like many other aspects that make people different, that we as human beings tend to see as making people different from ourselves, whether they be skin color, gender, religion, we see difference often as negative. I don't know what that is about human nature, but it is a reality. And so there is a tendency to single out people who are different, and over time, who has sort of had the difference of the day that was demonized or viewed as the most horrible changes. And then over time, the group pushes, and people who see things differently push to make change. And so while the difference between being of a same-sex sexual orientation and heterosexual is different in many ways than, for example, racial differences or religious differences, it's another difference that for a long time people have viewed as mattering, and we in more recent times have begun to realize really doesn't matter. And so the rubric of equal protection comes into play when you're dealing with differences that really don't matter, that don't change people's ability to be full members of society.
Great. Thank you. Shannon, anything on that?
Nope.
Okay. So the next question is going to be for you. Are you concerned with Justice Kennard's vote against granting review? And if so, how do you plan to address her possible concerns?
As the question indicates, when we filed the petitions with the court, Justice Kennard would have vote, well, did vote not to accept review of the case, which calls attention to the fact that the court's review of this case was discretionary. We could have started out filing in a lower court, and then the case would have made its way up through the regular appeals process. But given the importance of the issues at stake, we decided to file or seek, ask the California Supreme Court to accept original jurisdiction as a writ petition. So they do have the ability to do that. There is absolutely no way to know why Justice Kennard would have voted not to accept review of the case. There's been a lot of speculation about that. It is really, I think, misplaced. So we do not know. Could have been any number of considerations. I do not think it tells us anything whatsoever about her view of the merits of the case. And without speculating, because we really don't know, I would just point out that Justice Kennard has made it clear in prior cases that prior cases involving challenges to ballot initiatives, that she does not think these cases should be decided on an expedited basis. So it's possible she simply would have liked to see the case start in a lower court and come up through a slower and more deliberative appeals process. I don't know. Who knows? But I don't think it tells us anything about her view of the merits.
And I would just add to that, I would note that in her separate opinion concurring in the merits decision, Justice Kennard said that in holding that the right to marry may not be withheld on the ground of sexual orientation, this court discharges its gravest and most important responsibility under our constitutional form of government. So I'm not saying that that means she necessarily will agree with us that this is a revision, but she certainly grasps one facet of our argument, which is that this is a very important function of the judiciary, and to take it away from the judiciary and give it to the majority by simple majority vote is a fairly momentous change.
Okay. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on legal strategies in the fight for marriage equality. With our guests, Ms. Terry Stewart and Mr. Shannon Minter. I remind you that you can submit questions. We have quite a few, so we'll get through as many as we can. Do you think, this one's for you, Terry, or we'll start with you. Do you think the three dissenting justices in the marriage cases will adhere to that decision, in particular Justice Corrigan, who said that this should be decided by the voters?
Again, like Shannon, I never like to speculate about justices and how they're going to come out, because it's dangerous and it can insult them, and you usually are or often can be wrong. I think that you know, it's easy to assume that the justices who disagreed with the decision may feel that the voters should be able to do this in a simple way. But I'm not at all sure that that's the way they view our constitutional structure, and that it won't be of considerable concern to them that, I mean, this is, if this kind of change can happen here, there are many others that may be of more concern to them that could also be changed in this manner. So I don't really read too much. And then one other reason not to speculate on Justice Corrigan is she's only been on the California Supreme Court bench for a couple of years now. And so there's not a long history of these kinds of cases where you can read the tea leaves. So your guess is as good as mine.
Nothing more to add on that.
Okay. So the next one is yours, Shannon. Why was the argument of revision versus amendment not considered by the court in pre-election challenges to Proposition 8?
Well, we did file a pre-election challenge to Proposition 8 on that ground, arguing that it was an improper revision and should not even be presented to the voters. We did so, however, knowing there was virtually zero chance the court would grant that petition, because it is established precedent that the court will permit measures to go forward for a vote of the people, even if the court has grave concerns about the ultimate validity of the measure, on the grounds that it may not be passed, it may not be approved, in which case the case becomes moot. So in order to conserve judicial resources and not go through the whole exercise of determining whether a measure is valid before it's even enacted, the court does not do that. I will note, however, that I would very much like to see the court revisit that precedent, because I think it is very damaging to our state and to the democratic process and to just the social fabric of our state to allow a blatantly invalid initiative to go forward for a vote. And I think Proposition 8 is the perfect illustration of that. I feel like it was so toxic and so damaging to our state, so divisive and so costly, that if it turns out at the end of the day that the court does find it to be invalid, in a way it will have been a great shame to have put our state through that. On the other hand, I understand why they're reluctant to expend their resources when they may not have to. And again, it requires them, pre-election challenges require them to decide a very important issue in a very expedited time frame. So they're really between a rock and a hard place on that.
Okay. Okay, Terry, this one's for you. How, if at all, does the existence of California's domestic partnership law affect your arguments in this case?
I don't think it affects our arguments much at all. It was a significant fact of relevance in the marriage cases themselves, because it provided the backdrop of how the state treats lesbian and gay couples and families, that when you look at the validity of a law under the Constitution, under principles like equal protection and so forth, you evaluate the law in the context of the framework of laws that touch on related areas. So there, the fact that the court was really saying, look, aren't we really here focused on the difference in title and stature and name? And the answer to that was largely yes, and that framed the debate about what we were talking about in those cases. Here, I really don't think the fact of the domestic partner law existing makes a difference. The court has already held that the difference between the two is momentous. It is significant that having a separate regime for same-sex couples continues to project a message that they are somehow different in a way that matters, and that people are going to read as inferior. And that is a serious equal protection problem. And so that's, as Shannon said, the backdrop that we're dealing with here. And the question is, you know, is that something for the court to decide, or do the voters get to override that kind of decision?
Okay, Shannon, what is the best argument or the strongest argument of the proponents of Proposition 8 that you are most concerned about?
Well, you know, it has been interesting that the proponents have really ducked, I think, squarely confronting our arguments about the centrality of equal protection and just how unprecedented it is for an initiative to purport to take away a fundamental right only from a group defined by a suspect classification. What they have done instead is take the position, which I just do not think can be supported under the court's existing case law, that there are virtually no limits on what can be done through the amendment initiative process. The proponents have not distinguished or not acknowledged the very important constitutional distinction between revision, which is an exercise of the people's full, virtually unlimited sovereignty. It is true under the California Constitution, the people have the ultimate political power. But as Terry stressed, the people have exercised that ultimate sovereignty to establish limits on what can be done through the amendment process. So all we really have heard from the proponents over and over again is appeals to the primacy of the people's will. Yes, we agree with them on that. There's no argument on that. But the real issue in this case is what are the limits of what can be done through the amendment process. And a lot of what we've seen in their briefs actually is rehashing the arguments that were in front of the court in the marriage cases. And I do not believe, as indicated at the beginning, that the court is going to in any way be willing to revisit its prior holdings. Marriage is a fundamental right. Same-sex couples have that fundamental right. That this language that's at issue establishes a classification that discriminates based on sexual orientation. So that's just my view. The proponents really have not grappled very much with our arguments. I don't know what your views on that, Terry.
I agree. I mean, I think that they blur a lot of distinctions. And I like to think a little bit I don't know if this is a good way to express it, of the capital P people, the people when they exercise their full sovereign power, when they go through either the Constitutional Convention process or the other type of revision process, that very deliberative, careful, multi-step process. And there, they're exercising their whole power. And they have, the interveners merge that concept with what the people do when they vote for an initiative, which is I think of as sort of the little p people, in the sense that it's people exercising a lesser power, a power that they themselves put a constraint on, and it is a form of legislative power, but it is definitely a much more limited power than what you have when you go through the revision process, and so they mouth this power of the people, and they've also tried to make the case seem like it's a battle between judicial power and the power of the people, but it's really a battle about the people's restraints on themselves. It's a battle between, as I like to think of it, between the capital people, the people who were exercising their full sovereign power, and the little p people in the sense of the people when they exercise that lesser initiative power.
Okay. Did the coalition opposing Proposition 8 consider alternative legal theories before putting forward this one, assuming there were any? And if so, how did it reach the decision to pursue this strategy? So the question is, how did you reach the decision to pursue this strategy?
Well, yes, I mean, we've known for years now that we might very well end up in this very position. And this is something, these issues have been studied, examined, discussed, analyzed very carefully for a very long time. And I think it's no accident that we had three petitions, or the three petitions that were filed, all are advancing the same argument. This is the obvious argument to challenge Proposition 8. I mean, this is an established distinction in our constitutional system and structure. This is the most straightforward, narrow, and available based on precedent way to challenge Proposition 8. I think it is the correct legal argument. There's not a lot of other ways one could have challenged Proposition 8. The Attorney General has come up with another theory that, again, I think has a lot of merit, but I think it's broader than it needs to be.
Can you give us some examples of where an amendment process was successful?
Well, the most typical amendments, there have been many, many exercises by the people of the not of the initiative power generally and the what I call the initiative amendment power, that is, use of the initiative to amend the Constitution. The vast majority of those have nothing to do with fundamental rights or with equal protection. They'll have to do with things like the ability of the government to raise taxes and what kind of vote is required for that and what kind of constraints there are on it. They have to do with things like creating commissions or committees that have judicial power, the power to review certain kinds of decisions relating, for example, to public utilities. The number and different kinds of amendments is just wide, but they very, very seldom have anything to do with core fundamental rights and freedoms. There are a couple that have. One that the other side will focus on, has focused on, involved the death penalty. And the court had held in a case called People versus Anderson that the death penalty was, under our Constitution, cruel and unusual punishment. That standard for deciding what is cruel and unusual punishment is a standard that looks to the mores of contemporary society. It's kind of a democratic standard, if you will. The courts are primarily responsible for determining what that standard is. The voters overturned that decision and said, you know what, time out, we don't think the death penalty is cruel or unusual. And the court said that was acceptable as an amendment. We think that's quite different from amending the Constitution in a way that takes away rights from a minority. Because there, what you're dealing with is a provision that's designed to protect the minority from the majority. It's not and when the court looks at what violates equal protection, they don't say, well, what did the majority think about this? On the contrary, the whole reason we have that provision is because sometimes the majority is inclined to overlook the interests of the minority. And so it's a counter-majoritarian kind of principle that the courts are uniquely positioned to enforce. And so it's a very different change in the structure of our Constitution to alter that kind of fundamental principle than it is to look to the majority for a standard that essentially is about what the people in today's society think.
Okay.
Anything? Oh, no, just to reinforce what Terry said, the scope of what can be addressed through the amendment initiative process is very broad, and the vast majority of amendments are perfectly valid. I mean, what has happened with Prop 8 is extremely unusual, and, you know, thankfully, most time, there's very few initiatives that are targeted at a particular group and designed to take rights away from a particular group. And if this one is permitted to stand, it will be the first time that has ever happened successfully in the history of our state.
And that leads very nicely into our next question. What are the parallels to the case regarding interracial marriage?
Well, analytically, as a legal matter, there is no difference between Proposition 8 and a proposed amendment that would change the California Constitution to bar interracial marriage. Race is also obviously a suspect classification. From an analytic point of view, those are the issue would be identical. And I think that helps underscore what a shocking and radical and drastic departure this proposition is from just the basic premises of our constitutional system. The reason we have a constitution is to provide the same basic rights for everybody. The preamble to the California Constitution talks about the importance of establishing a constitution to protect and secure liberty for all people. There's something very deeply irrational, counterintuitive, illogical about enacting a constitutional provision that is actually designed to take rights away from a minority group. It's not the way our system works.
I would say one more thing about the interracial marriage case. I think that the Perez case, in which our high court held that the ban on interracial marriage was unconstitutional, happened 20 years before the U.S. Supreme Court made a similar decision. And one of the arguments that the interveners, represented by Ken Starr, have made is, well, don't worry, we have the federal constitution, we have the federal courts. So if we kind of take away equal protection in our state constitution, we shouldn't worry because the federal constitution's there. And what it's really, we're well to remember in that circumstance, the number of times in which our high court has been well ahead or even has decided things that to this day the U.S. Supreme Court has never decided, whether it be in the area of issues of race, of gender, of sexual orientation. In all of those areas, our court has been ahead in time and remains ahead in doctrine in terms of protecting the rights of minorities. So our state constitution plays a really important role in the protection of our fundamental rights and in the protection of minorities. And if we want to chuck that now, I guess we can, but I'm not all that comfortable, and I think the Perez case kind of is an example of why not.
Okay, we have room for one, perhaps two more questions. If Proposition 8 is overturned by the courts, would this finally be considered a closed case, or could it be challenged once again in some other way?
My understanding is that if the court were to invalidate Proposition 8, that would actually and finally be the end of the matter. There's no higher court of appeal where all of our challenges are under the state constitution, so there's no possibility of any appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that would be the end of it.
Okay.
I hope so.
And will the Supreme Court judges have the political will to uphold their previous 5-4 vote in the face of being accused of practicing judicial tyranny, hence disenfranchising the voters?
Actually, let me just correct it. It was a 4-3 vote. We have seven justices on our court. But I don't think it's a question of political will. I have no doubt that this court will do its job faithfully and will do everything that it can to put aside considerations of politics, of being unpopular, of being, you know, people who accuse courts of being activists do it selectively. They do it when they don't like a decision of the court. But studies have shown that judges who tend to decide things in ways that are acceptable to conservatives are just as apt to be considered or actually be, quote, activist in some sense than others. So I think it's one of those words that gets bandied about to try to intimidate judges. I don't think Chief Justice Ron George is a man who's easily intimidated. If he was, he wouldn't have decided the marriage cases the way that he did. He's by nature cautious in his judicial thinking, and I think the court has a lot of judicial decisions that were made before, the nine that I mentioned, as well as the whole jurisprudence in the area of equal protection and fundamental rights, to weigh and to consider and to think how that all fits together. I'm not prepared to say that if we were to lose this case, it's for a failure of political will. I think the court will, in good faith, look at the issues, look at the case law, try to make a decision based on the Constitution and on what that means in this context. And good or bad for us, it will have been an impartial, thoughtful decision that's not political. And if we win, I think the same thing is true. It won't be about politics. It will be about the law.
Thank you. Our thanks to Ms. Terry Stewart and Mr. Shannon Minter, and also to all of you in our audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Don't go anywhere. Now, if I would like to do, we're off the recording, but there are a few more questions. If you'd like me to ask them of Terry and Shannon, I'm happy to do that. If you'd like to just go to free form and come up and chat with them, I'm happy to do that too. What's your will? Questions? Okay. You willing?
Sure.
Okay. All right. What is the most important thing that gay and lesbian couples can do now to promote equal rights?
Be out of the closet. I think, in my opinion, and I think Shannon and I may have differences of view, I think that being out not only about being lesbian or gay, but talking about your family, being open about your family, talking to as many people as you know who might not be wholly comfortable with who you are, but that you may know because they're parents in the same school as your children, or because they're neighbors, or because they go to a church that you go to, or for any other reason, you're the people who work at your grocery store, to get to know them and to let them know who you are as human beings and who you are as a couple or a family or both. I think that's critically important. It's always been at the center of our movement, and I think we have to keep heading in that direction, and we, you know, that's the way to change. In the end, we have to change the way that people view it as a majority, and we have to get there by showing them who we are.
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, I completely agree with that. You know, I mean, it's easy to get very focused on the litigation and the court case and legislation and these political battles, but, you know, at the end of the day, what has changed our world more than anything else is just LGBT people openly and authentically living their lives and taking the risk of being open about that. It's very scary, and it's something that our community, as much progress as we have made on that front, and people are so much more out and so much more open than they were even like a decade ago. Being willing to talk about the negative impact of being denied full equality is still very difficult for most of us. I'll speak for myself. It is a very hard thing to share with your family and friends. It's not easy to talk about that level of vulnerability and to make yourself open to talking even to your family members that you love. You don't want them to worry about you. You don't want them to feel bad. You don't want to talk about your own vulnerability. And I feel like our community is just now, just in the past few years, fully engaged in the process of doing that. And it is having a transformative effect beyond anything we have seen before. And that is where the real action lies. You know, we may win this case. We very well may not win this case. And it does, either way, that is the most critical, transformative, life-changing, life-affirming actions that we can all be doing. And that is ultimately what it's all about.
Okay, great. Can you address the legal argument that Prop 8 is invalid because it amended the Constitution to conflict with itself?
Well, Shannon talked earlier about harmonizing provisions of the Constitution. But really, if a Constitution is amended in a way that's a legitimate way of going about it that meets the constitutional requirements, it can, in a sense, contradict a prior principle. It can change a prior principle. So I think the fact that Prop 8 contradicts with equal, you know, doesn't square with equal protection, doesn't square with fundamental rights, it really begs the question of whether that kind of change can be accomplished through the method that the voters used as opposed to the revision method. But if it were held to be a valid amendment, then you have an exception carved from general principles in a more specific takeaway. As Shannon mentioned, that would be unprecedented. And it would be really grave, and I think it basically is the death knell for equal protection in our state constitution. But the question really becomes, can it be done that way?
Okay. Is the AG stating that an inalienable right could be amended by the people so long as there is a compelling state interest? And if so, what is the compelling state interest put forth by the AG? Keep in mind, these aren't my questions.
Sure. No, I think that's a very good question, actually. And yes, the Attorney General is saying his position is that inalienable rights can be amended if there is a compelling state interest for doing so. Now, let me be super clear that he is saying there is no compelling state interest in this case, and that Proposition 8 is invalid and should be struck down. And it's difficult to imagine what possibly could constitute a sufficiently compelling state interest to override an inalienable right, but that is, in the equal protection context, established doctrine. I mean, it is established that the state can discriminate based on race or sex or religion or sexual orientation if there is a sufficiently compelling reason to do so. Difficult to imagine what that could be. I can't come up with anything, that's for sure. But
And largely, the court considered every possible interest that could be advanced for making this distinction between same-sex and opposite-sex couples when it decided the marriage cases. And it found no compelling state interest. And so if they didn't come up with it then, I'm not quite sure what further interest or issue could be advanced that would rise to that level.
I mean, you can imagine situations like if we're thinking of, well, the liberty is an inalienable interest protected in Article 1, Section 1. If there was some kind of national emergency, maybe there could be a compelling state interest to restrict liberty. I think that's the kind of scenario that the Attorney General is envisioning. Not any sort of interest that would ever justify discrimination. I doubt seriously that he would even contemplate there could be such a thing.
Okay. The Supreme Court seems to support the, quote, right to privacy, end quote, under the 14th Amendment. Is this relevant to the case at hand?
Well, I think if you mean the California Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court has applied the right to privacy that has been an express part of our Constitution. There is an actual right to privacy in the inalienable rights section that we added in 1972. So when the California Supreme Court applied the right to privacy in the marriage cases, it was looking to our Constitution, not to the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court has found implied a right of privacy under various provisions of the federal Constitution. And some of the early decisions that recognize that federal constitutional right were the predicate for the amendment to our Constitution that added an express right to privacy. And they had to do with a couple of different kinds of privacy, one of which, the one that was most important here, is what's called autonomy privacy. And that's not the privacy to kind of keep information private, but rather the privacy to make decisions about important issues that affect your life, family-related issues, marriage, whether to use contraception, whether to have children, not have children, marry, not marry, who to marry, without having the government interfere with those decisions. So that was the kind of privacy interest that the California Supreme Court was applying when it held that the marriage statutes violated the fundamental right to privacy.
Okay. I've got two more questions, essentially. Is the amendment versus revision argument a Hail Mary pass?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This will be, however it comes out, one of the most serious and important constitutional cases our court has ever decided. This is a critical issue. I mean, we're going to know after this case whether the people can, through the amendment initiative process, take away fundamental rights from minority groups. If the court holds that that is a permissible use of the initiative process, I'm sure that we are going to see other future measures. The most likely ones are additional measures targeting LGBT people.
But you can imagine others.
You can imagine others.
People of a Muslim faith, Latinos, immigrants. As I said, who is unpopular in the moment changes over time. But we've never had a dearth of candidates, I don't think ever, that I'm aware of. So those kinds of measures are not theoretical. We've had them historically. Maybe some of the ones we've had in the past we've gotten over, but we always seem to find new ones.
Yeah, I mean, just this has not happened before. There's other states that have amended their state constitutions to bar same-sex couples from marriage, but no state has done that after recognizing that sexual orientation is the suspect classification or after recognizing that same-sex couples have a fundamental right to marry. So this could, if we lose this case, have a very tragic dimension, which is that our society's failure to quite yet fully accept the humanity of LGBT people could lead to a state constitutional decision that opens the door to some very ugly future measures that affect everybody in the state. It's about as serious as it gets in terms of constitutional issues.
Okay. So this is the last question is actually a couple of questions combined. This would seem like a slam dunk that we will win in the Supreme Court. Do you agree? If not, what is your best guess for the outcome? We're not being recorded, so you can say it like it is.
I never think any case is a slam dunk. Usually cases don't get this far, and they're certainly not this hotly contested if they're a slam dunk, because they get resolved or settled or avoided. And I think there are challenges for us in this case. There are challenges, primarily the challenge is it's a case of first impression. And in cases of first impression, courts have to interpret prior cases and look at constitutional principles, and they're not easy. They're complex. And they're, you know, you have to square prior precedents that might be similar in one way and different in another way and so forth. So I think it's a case that's challenging for both sides. I am optimistic in the sense that I think we have a very good shot. I think fundamentally, for the reasons Shannon just articulated, because of the grave consequences of the court ruling against us for a much broader range of issues than same-sex couples being permitted to marry, we have a good chance of persuading the court that this is the right outcome. But I would not call that a slam dunk.
Nor would I. No, you know, it's a very challenging case. And it pits the two most central premises of our constitutional system in a way, which is majority rule and minority rights. And the court has really got to grapple with that. I am 100% convinced that our argument is correct. I am deeply convinced it will be a tragedy for our state if we lose the case. But I know the court will give it utmost consideration. I don't think they're going to pay any attention to the politics of it. They're going to be focused like a laser on the state constitutional issues here. And I'm with Terry. I'm optimistic, but would never dare to dream of making any sort of prediction.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much. This has been, I think, probably one of the best programs I've ever participated in. So thank you, and thank you all for your incredible questions.